We study billionaires, and this is episode 122 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pysh and Stig Brodersen.
Hey, how's everybody doing out there? This is Preston Pysh, and I'm your host for the Investors Podcast. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Brodersen, out in Seoul, South Korea. And we have an exciting interview for you today because we have one of our good friends, Wesley Gray, with us today. And if you haven't heard our previous episode with Wes, you're in for a treat because he is insanely bright, and you're going to find that out real soon here as we start asking him some amazing questions. So Wes got his undergrad at Wharton. He went to Chicago Booth. He has a PhD. He's written 4 books. Last time he was here, we were talking a little bit more about his book, Quantitative Value. But today, Wes has a new book that has recently come out. And we talked about this just a little bit on the first episode about mixing momentum investing with value investing. And Wes, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say that you have your roots in value investing. Is that a correct statement?
100% correct. I'm a Ben Graham, intelligent investor, Bible thumper originally. Still am to this day. You got it.
But so you run in this crowd with Patrick O'Shaughnessy and a couple others. I know James is big on this. I know Toby's big on this. Toby Carlisle, who's in our mastermind group, that you're mixing this value investor, Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham approach, but you're slightly mixing it with a little bit of momentum investing, because when you've done all this back testing, you've been able to prove that you can actually get a better result by having this blend. And correct me if I'm wrong, the blend is, you know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking it's around 70% value to 30% momentum. Is it somewhere around in that figure, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on how you want to slice and dice it. But the basic idea is, you know, value works, basically overreaction to bad news. Momentum works. It's an underreaction to good news. And they're kind of like yin and yang because they're like two religions. So the value guys think momentum's stupid. The momentum guys think the value guys are stupid. And so they're actually natural complements. And if you believe at all in, you know, portfolio theory, and you know, understand value investors rightly, you know, don't believe in a lot of it. But the basic idea of pooling things that are kind of yin and yang makes a lot of sense. If both things are, you know, high expected return and high volatility, if you can pool those two together and they kind of cancel each other out when, you know, value is doing bad and maybe momentum's doing great, I mean, that's a good thing from a kind of a risk management standpoint.
So before we dive into the first question, so everyone who's listening to this show, this is what this episode is all about. Most of our audience are value investors like Stig and myself. So we like talking about macro. We like talking about these other things because they're interesting topics. But at the end of the day, we are hardcore value investors that really don't exercise a lot of momentum investing. So I think that this is going to be a fantastic episode for people out there listening. This is the direction we're going. We're going to be talking about momentum investing and how you can maybe augment or include a small portion of this in your portfolio to increase your returns. And Wes can talk the stats on this. He is a data-driven kind of person, so he can get into the nitty-gritty details of that as we go through the rest of the interview. Before we jump into the first question, I'm kind of curious where you kind of discovered this approach. How did you come across this, Wes?
Well, basically, you know, I start off doing the value investing thing because that just makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, look at firms as a business, buy them cheap, buy them with margin of safety, etc. Great. And then what's really nice about that kind of story is there's actually a lot of evidence backing it up. And when you look at value investing, you got to ask, well, why does this actually work? And I think we talked about it on the last podcast, but really any investment strategy works to the extent that you can essentially front run future expectations. So value works because when you buy cheap stuff that everyone hates, it tends to be the case that in the future, expectations tend to get revised in your favor. And by simply buying cheap stuff that everyone hates, you can kind of front run that, right? And so value makes sense. The data's there. And from an expectation front running standpoint, it's a great trade. The whole thing's, you know, got a good mojo to it. Well, it turns out that when you look at momentum, it's the same thing. It's all about a way to front run expectation changes. And so any strategy where you're able to do that, you're going to make money, right? Because value investing will not make you money, because if you just buy cheap stuff and no one ever agrees with you, i.e. expectations never change to be in favor of what you think, like this is a cheap stock, you're just going to always own a cheap stock, right? And so you always need, even value investors need to rely on the fact that at some point, expectations change. In the value investor viewpoint, fundamentals matter. So it eventually it'll drag the expectation in that direction. But that's an assumption that expectations will go to that. And it turns out to be a good assumption. And but I think that same sort of logic of, okay, how are we going to front run other market participants, get ahead of that game? Well, momentum tends to be a great signal to do that. And arguably, well, it's not even an argument. Like the data is more strong for momentum than value, just from a straight like evidence-based standpoint.
Perfect introduction, Wesley. And before we dig into the first question, we probably said that a few times before we dig into the first question, but I just want to add one thing more, guys. Wes, you were on episode 48 and 49, and we'll make sure to link to those episodes in the show notes, because we talked a few times about, well, you've been on a podcast before, we discussed some of it, but we definitely see this episode as a continuation of those episodes. But clearly, we're also going to talk about some of the standard elements and explain the concept in this episode as well. But Wes, I would like to turn the very first question into a brief history lesson. So in your new book, Quantitative Momentum, you describe the birth of technical analysis, and you talk about how it was developed in the Netherlands, later in Japan, and how billionaires like George Soros, Stan Druckenmiller, and Paul Tudor Jones later become very successful with the approach. Could you please take us back in history and talk about the modern technical analysis approach?
Sure. So, I mean, I can only take you back as far as like documented history that we could find will take us. You know, we get back to around the 1600s. I talk about, you know, De La Vega, where he's in the Netherlands there, you know, and he's basically mentioning behavioral finance, how people participate in markets. And a lot of times it's all about the technicals. And, you know, it all boils down to what my old roommate tells me. High prices attract buyers, low prices attract sellers. And this guy's retired already, and we're not. And he was a market maker at Deutsche Bank for like 10 years. And he's basically explaining momentum. And so I think this is something that, you know, you can look way back. A lot of people have been doing this for a long time. And what's interesting is when you start getting into formalized research, you know, it's like anything. There's always like, it seems like there's a dark age. So momentum, in the specific application that we talk about in our book and what is under discussion here, is using momentum to select stocks. This idea, you know, was originally taught, like Gary Antonacci talks about the Colin Jones paper in 1937. You know, it's kind of more of a trend follow thing, but kind of hints on momentum. 1937, okay, that was a long time ago. Robert Levy, 1967, publishes a paper on relative strength strategies in stocks, in the Journal of Finance, for God's sake, the top tier academic journal. Okay, what happens also about that time? Well, Eugene Fama publishes his dissertation in 1965, and all of a sudden, you get the efficient market mafia kind of starts controlling the thought. It's all about math. It's all about modern portfolio theory. This 1967 paper that basically shows that you can just use simple price patterns to basically beat the market. You know, these guys get buried and they're not allowed to basically talk for another 30 years. And then you got Jagadish and Tintman, 93, who a lot of people say is like, quote unquote, when momentum was found. Well, I just talked about a paper that was published 30 years prior to that and another paper published 30 years prior to that even. And so everyone's been saying, oh, momentum's a new thing. It's going to get arbed out. Now that everyone knows about it, you know, recently everyone's been saying, oh, momentum's dead. Well, there's my old boss, Chris Gatesy, has a paper where they got data from 1800 to 1927. So basically 120 years out of sample data. And guess what? Momentum works just as well then as it did in the last 100 years. However, just like value, you get your face ripped off sometimes. And that's why it worked.
So, Wes, without jumping into, you know, questions later on, for a person who's hearing that response, I think the thing that immediately jumps into your head is, how do you protect yourself from that event that you just described as being just totally cataclysmic event as you're implementing this momentum strategy and it just totally does not work? How does a person mitigate that risk from happening?
Sure. So the best way someone described momentum investing to me was actually from a value investor, this guy, Charles Mizrahi. He says momentum investing is like this. Value investing, you drive in a slow, boring car in the slow lane. You kind of grind it out. You know, the Ferraris pass you by and you always look stupid. You know, a lot, you kind of grind it. Sometimes your car breaks down and you're screwed and you lose a lot of money, but whatever. It's just kind of a grinder strategy. Like, momentum is basically a strategy where you're always in the fast lane going 100 miles an hour. And the minute that lane ahead of you starts slowing down, you switch lanes. Like, value is kind of a long-term, hold, grind it out type strategy. Momentum, necessarily, it's momentum. So the minute something starts losing momentum, you got to get out of that thing, get out of that lane, because you're going 100 miles an hour. So it's just a total different way of an approach. But that's how you protect yourself in momentum, is the minute there isn't momentum, get out and move to what has momentum. And that tends to historically give you a lot of bang for the buck. Has a lot of vol, just like value, but it's you're not just like riding these things down to zero, because mechanically you're going to get out and move the high momentum.
And when we talk about the things you're really paying attention to, it's all price action, right? It's just all the price that's being paid for the security, nothing else.
Yeah, and that's a proxy for what a lot of people argue is related to fundamental action, basically underreaction. So like, guys can basically map, there's a Novi Marks paper that does it essentially, where if you look at earnings releases, right, there tends to be, for a reason, like underreaction to these earnings releases. So people release unexpected positive earnings. You'd expect the stock to move to the quote unquote fundamental value. It never does. It moves up and then it kind of drifts. Well, you know, momentum is a way, just using the price, you essentially capture that as well. But people can map prices, the price appreciation, to fundamental releases of information that, for whatever reason, anchoring biases, what have you, like, the market just doesn't react fast enough for some reason. It's unclear why that is, but it is. So even though you use price as the proxy or returns, it's not like it's just, that's it. It a lot of times does map back to like a fundamental element there, which is basically underreaction to good news. It was, I think, what most of the evidence suggests.
And just very briefly, for people out there listening and thinking, I heard about this, I have a really good understanding of what value investing is. Could you just briefly explain momentum investing? It's like, if you have a stock, call it $10, and it drops to $5, as a value investor, you'd be thinking, this might be now trading at a lower price. There might be some value there I can gain. Whereas that's not what you're looking for at all as a momentum investor. You're looking for that stock going from $5 to $10 and saying that there might be a strong indication that it might continue. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes. So value investing, you know, in traditional sense, is basically buy cheap stuff, right? And that's great. Got it. Momentum investing is basically buy relative strength. So when we talk about stock selection, there's two types of momentum. There's, you know, kind of trend following momentum, or what they call time series momentum. That's like looking at a stock at a current point in time relative to its history and making a decision based on that. So it's in isolation. What we're talking about here, the geek term, is called cross-sectional momentum, or the practitioner term is relative strength. So here, we don't really care if you're up 10% or even down 10%, as long as you're relatively doing well to other securities in your universe. So if you're negative 10, but the other guys are negative 50, the evidence is pretty clear that the negative 10 guy will continue to have strong relative performance than the negative 50 guy. So, but it's not about just, we're talking about the absoluteness of it is not what we're looking here. It's the relative momentum that is really the documented effect as far as stock selection.
Now, when you say relative momentum, relative to other companies in that industry is what you're comparing them to?
You can do that, or you can just do it across all securities, people do it within industry. Like, it doesn't matter, but as long as it's in the relative is what matters. So as long as you have momentum relative to whatever universe you're operating in, that is the signal that seems to, you know, kind of drive this empirical phenomenon that's been around forever.
Very interesting.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
So, Wes, could you explain the concept of behavioral finance and why it hints at the framework for being a successful active investor? And I know in your book, you provide a poker analogy. So could you kind of give our audience a glimpse of that?
Yeah, sure. And so this framework, which I'll outline to you guys, we call it the Sustainable Active Investing Framework. This is a framework through which you can review any strategy, value investing, momentum investing, Ouija board investing, or whatever. The idea is if you can't map it into this framework and identify the edge, it's not real. It's data mining. So essentially the way it works, and this is really just academic behavioral finance, but most people think that behavioral finance is about behavior. So understanding how investors have all kinds of weird psychology problems, they make bad decisions, and then they do stupid things in the market. But that's not really interesting. Because if it was only about behavior, and if there was one really smart person, they would just go get billions of dollars and exploit all those people, and it wouldn't matter because they would just arbitrage them away like ASAP. So, but in order to make behavioral finance interesting, you need to identify, one, decision-making errors. So why do people do stupid stuff in the first place and sell stocks too cheap or whatever? But then also, why in the hell aren't the arbitrage guys taking advantage of it? Because only then will you actually see these effects in the data. Because if it's driven by a behavioral issue, and then we also understand the market frictions or why other smart people aren't doing it, now we have like a real effect that we can actually see in the data and try to understand it. And so essentially what the Sustainable Active Framework suggests is we got to answer two questions whenever we're doing any sort of long-term investment strategy that purports to have any sort of edge over just buying a Vanguard fund, which is amazing, right? Because it's cheap, tax efficient, and you own everything. Incredible. The first question is, you know, I'll use the poker table analogy. Who are the bad poker players at this table that I'm sitting at here? And that's where we get into the behavioral stuff, right? Like, who's the idiots that are, you know, selling these great companies that crazy PE ratios, you know, because they've got overreaction biases or representativeness or whatever it is. We need to identify what is the underlying psychological problem with people that are investors out there making decisions, because that's going to create this sort of initial mispricing. So you've identified the bad poker players at the table, but we don't operate in a world where it's only bad poker players. We operate in a world where there's people with PhDs in physics and math, people that got 30 years of stock picking like Warren Buffett type. So we need to understand what are the best poker players at the table doing. And if we identify situations like value investing, we're okay, we kind of understand the behavioral reasons of why these opportunities exist. You know, it's really hard to do. It's really painful strategy. Like, that's great because the best poker players have a friction. They can't just easily exploit this. And so value works like that. Well, let's think about momentum. Well, value, the behavioral core behavioral bias, arguably is overreaction to bad news, right? People throw the baby out the bathwater. You know, that's a simple way of saying it. Great. Why don't the best poker players do it? Because it's painful as hell and they all lose their job, right? Who wants to do that if you do like active value investing? Well, what's momentum? Arguably, the behavioral bias there is this is an underreaction to fundamental good news that price signals are telling us. In fact, they're yelling at us that this is the case, and yet people underreact to that price signal because they're overconfident in their own information set. So that's kind of one of the core leading theories about the behavior that drives momentum. And then, well, why don't all the best poker players do it? Well, just like value, if you do momentum strategies, you are going to look like the biggest idiot in the entire planet for potentially 5-10 year stretches. That's great because that means it's sustainable. You can't be like a prop shop, lever the strategy up and arbit away immediately. And so bottom line is those two questions. Who are the bad poker players? Great, we need that because they cause mispricing. Second question, why isn't Warren Buffett or why aren't like all the other smart people managing billions of dollars doing it? If we understand their limitations, now we have a real kind of sustainable opportunity. And I just am of the belief that value and momentum fit in that framework pretty effectively.
Very, very interesting, Wes. And I think this is a really good transition into the next question, because one of the ideas that I got from you by following your research and reading your blog and your work is that you have explained about an investment style box, or if I should just explain this. So traditionally, when we have an investment style box, it's usually 3x3. So it's divided into three rows with big, mid, and small cap, and then three columns with value, blend, and growth. And this is like the way that we usually see this box. So whenever we are looking at an ETF, for instance, it will be in one of those nine squares in terms of explaining what type of ETF it is. Now, you suggest that perhaps we should replace growth with momentum. Could you please explain why we might need to rethink growth and replace it with momentum in the future?
Sure. So it depends on your objective function. If you're trying to closet index and minimize tracking error, growth is great. If you're trying to maximize expected return and play the buckets that the evidence suggests will actually, you know, generate excess return over long periods of time, you don't want to think in terms of growth, because growth without momentum is a sucker bet. It's what every value investor in the world knows is a bad idea. Overpaying for hype, you know, buying the latest, greatest scheme out there that the street's pumping, the newest IPO, like basically expensive stocks, right? That we already know. All value investors know, total sucker bet. But momentum is not growth, or it is not expensive stocks. Momentum is momentum. Momentum is What is your performance relative to other securities in the universe, independent of fundamentals, right? You could be a high-flying 100 PE stock and have high momentum. You could also be, like recently, because you guys probably appreciate this like I do, small cap value has been face ripping, rocking, right? A lot of those stocks are momentum right now. So you could actually have a circumstance right now where you can be value and you could be momentum. But the key is you don't want to buy expensive stuff, which is growth. What you want to buy is you want to buy value and then momentum, where momentum is high relative strength, not growth, where growth typically means expensive 100 PE securities. Momentum can be that, but doesn't necessarily have to be that. And so the idea is if you want to maximize expectation and not just worry about trying to cover all the buckets of the market, you know, value is one area you want to focus and momentum is another. And those are the two spectrums you want to be in, for at least from what the evidence suggests, if you actually care about quote unquote trying to beat the market or generate risk premiums in excess of just, you know, buying the Vanguard fund.
So Wes, I'm curious if you could dig into a little bit more defining the difference between growth and momentum, because I think the typical person listening right now, they haven't made that difference yet. So let me just try to put it in my own terms and then you kind of self-correct off of what I'm saying here. So when you're talking growth, you're talking about, call it like an Amazon company where you're looking at the top line revenues, you're seeing them grow at a rapid pace, and you're expecting that to just go off into oblivion and just keep shooting into the stratosphere. That would be more of what we commonly refer to as a growth pick. Now, when you're talking about momentum, you're really looking at just the price action of the stock. So let's say it's Amazon again, and you saw, compared to other tech companies, or let's just say the S&P 500 in general, you're seeing that price action and it's moving twice as fast as any other stock out there. We would label that momentum. Is that a correct interpretation of this? And if not, just kind of hit the delta.
Yeah, yeah, that's really good. And let me go really slow here, because this is like a nuanced point that matters so much. So let's go back to the value anomaly as it's documented. It basically says, let's just take PE ratio. We got 1,000 stocks. The value anomaly basically says that if we simply buy the cheapest 100 and we compare the performance on that to the most expensive 100, you get this huge spread. Depending on the size cuts or whatever, let's say it's 5%, or, you know, anywhere from 2 to 8%, depending on what, you know, the size levels are. But it's huge, right? That's a massive difference over 100 years, a 2 to 4% kind of spread. The low PE stocks are called value in academic research. The high PE stocks are considered growth or glamour or what have you, right? Got it. Momentum says we're not looking at any E. We're looking at P. That's it. And we're not only looking at P, we're looking at how P compares to the other P's in the market, i.e. P where P's the price. So with momentum, you say, okay, now we got 1,000 stocks. We're going to rank them on their last 1 year performance and we're going to sort them. The top 100, they're going to probably have, you know, 50%, 60% returns. The bottom 100 are going to have probably whatever, negative 10, negative 20. The spread between those top 100 and those bottom 100 is like double value premium. So if value, depending on how you cut the size, is 2 to 4, you know, momentum is going to be 4 to 8. So just the absolute spread there is different. And the key differentiation is growth is about P to E, expensive stuff. Momentum is about relative strength, price movement. And that little difference matters so much, because if you have a growth stock, i.e. a expensive security, if it doesn't have momentum, it's got a bad expectation. If that security has momentum, but it just happens to be also an expensive stock, you have a good expectation. And that little nuance is all that matters. And you hit it right when you said Amazon. Amazon, you know, expectations off the wall. Like right now, I don't even know what the PE is. It's probably like infinity, but it's also been getting its face ripped. So it doesn't have as much momentum as it used to have. So that's becoming less attractive to a momentum investor.
Yeah.
But go back 6-7 months ago, Amazon still has a PE of an infinity, but who cares? It has amazing momentum. So it's that momentum characteristic that drives this. and it's independent of the valuation. It's a total kind of different way of thinking than value investors typically think.
Fantastic.
Which is fine.
Yeah, no, that clears it up. It's crystal clear when you describe it that way. Now, I'm just kind of curious on this, Wes, because I know you're a huge quant guy. You are all about the numbers and going back and back testing and all that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of curious what the average duration that you would, if you had a basket of, call it 100 momentum picks over a certain amount of time, how long were you holding on to these picks on average? What would you say that number is?
Well, I mean, in order to get it to work, it's way higher turnover, 3 to 4 times. So value, here's some basic empirical facts. You take a value strategy, right? Let's just say low PE just for ease here. So we're just going to be Ben Graham, buy cheap stocks, low PE. If I go buy the cheapest 100 stocks right now, and if I 5-year rebalance that, I still got some edge. If I 1-year rebalance that, I got a lot more edge. If I quarterly rebalance, I got a little more edge. And if I monthly rebalance, I got a lot of, and you can go crazy on it, right? But value, you could hold that for 5 years out and you're still going to have an edge. Momentum is, like I say, you're driving a fast car. And if that fast car has a wreck in front of it, if you don't change lanes, you're dead, right? So momentum, you have to turn that thing over and rebalance that portfolio quarterly to frankly get any of the benefits of it. And it's just the nature of it. And if you do it monthly, it's even better, which means that momentum, while way more compelling, is also way more trading intensive and arguably has a lot less scalability to it than value. Because value, as I mentioned, you know, you could buy stocks and hold for 5 years and capture some of the edge. In momentum, you have to trade it at least quarterly. And your turnover, I'm just going to throw it out there, but maybe you get 200% a year turnover, where maybe a value strategy, depending on how fast you rebalance, it may be half that or a quarter of that. It's just the nature of the two anomalies. They're just vastly different.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
So Wes, so a person hearing this, like my immediate thought when you hear that the turnover is higher, which is what I totally expected, I think I'm going to be paying taxes through the nose. So how can I invest in an ETF or a fund where somebody's actively managing this, but I buy it once and I, let's just say that I incorporate this as a 15% position in my portfolio so that I don't have to be doing this buying and selling and paying, you know, all the taxes that are associated.
Yeah, so there's two schools of thought on that. I mean, one of the things that's actually unique about a momentum strategy, even if you didn't have any special tax wrapper on it, is, you know, you're buying the winners and basically cutting the losers. And so you're mechanically always booking capital losses. And then a lot of times you're letting those winners ride. So you do have a lot of turnover, but you can have names that, you know, end up being 10Xs and you hold them for 5 years. So there is some tax efficiency innate to momentum, or at least not as bad as one would think at the outset. But of course, as you mentioned, and it is intuitive, because of that trading activity, you are going to generate a ton of capital gain liabilities. So you need to find structures. Like, you know, obviously we like the ETF structure because it allows us to, internal to that structure, avoid capital gain distribution. So, you know, a buy and hold investor can basically access that turnover without, you know, having to eat in 1099 distributions every year. But you can also use it in qualified accounts. And if you're, you know, really rich, there's all kinds of other schemes you can do. But 100% agree. If you're going to do momentum and you're a taxable person, you need to wrap it in a tax vehicle. An ETF is probably the most accessible one for, you know, not billionaire types.
So at this point in time in the show, we would really like to respond to one of the questions from the audience. And Wes, I know that we're really putting you on the spot here, but I really hope that you would like to help Preston and me out with this question. Does that sound good?
Yeah, I mean, our mission is empower investors through education, so send it on down.
All right, so our first question comes from Brian Kirby.
Hi, Stig and Preston. This is Brian Kirby from New Hampshire. Thanks for all the work you put into the podcast. I'm new to value investing. Over the past year, I've been trying to accumulate as much knowledge as I can on value investing, investing in individual companies. Your podcast has been very key in that journey. I'm starting to look at individual companies and their 10Ks. What sections of the 10Ks do you feel are the most important? Thank you.
All right, Wes, you take it away.
If we're talking about value investing and we're talking about 10Ks, there's a few areas you want to look at. One, you want to first figure out what the heck the price is, which isn't in the 10K. But after you do that, we're big fans of operating income, or kind of, you know, measures of profitability that are a little bit further up the income statement, not net income, because it can be gamed a lot. Another thing you want to focus on, there's actually a really cool paper about this. And I'm a quant guy, so I'll give you a quant perspective. But what some researchers did is they actually look at 10Ks and they machine read them, because for, you know, 99% of them are templated. But what they did is they said, hey, all these lawyers, they make you write this templated language. But what happens when the template language changes? And specifically, is there certain sections of the 10K where when the language changes, it really matters the future performance? And one of those is actually in risk factors. If you just look at the template language and risk factor section, and you do it year over year, or quarter over quarter, however you want to do it. And again, I recommend doing a computer, but if you don't have a computer to do it, you can do it by hand. Whenever you start seeing additional risk factors list in there, i.e. the lawyers are like, guys, we need to kind of cover our ass here. And we don't want to talk about this publicly, but this is our disclosure document. So we need to legally disclose this here. But, you know, because obviously they're not going to make this front and center on the conference calls. But I would focus on that risk factor section. And don't just read it absolutely, read it relatively to what they've said in the past. If you all of a sudden see a whole addition of risk factors,
that's like a momentum way of seeing the relative change in a 10.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's crazy, man. These guys use a computer to literally like machine read, and they look for these changes. And they, and risk factors is where a lot of these CEOs like go bury information that's super relevant to market expectations. But because obviously they're CEOs, they don't want to like talk about these things or emphasize them. So a lot of times it kind of goes to the wayside, but it's highly predictive of basically poor performance.
Because that is so true. You know that they'd have the lawyers just adding all sorts of, that is so smart. And I've never heard that before. I really like that comment. That was amazing.
I'll give you one more that's also just kind of varsity level fundamental, but there's another thing you do is like customer supplier relationships. There's an old trading strategy where, you know, basically in those 10Ks, you got to disclose over 10% revenue partners. And obviously, like, let's say Stig, and there's a class of examples like golf clubs. So Stig is Callaway Golf, and I'm like a head supplier for golf clubs. If all of a sudden you want to follow Callaway Golf, if you come out and Stig says, dude, my sales are horrific, and you're analyzing me, the company that's making the golf heads, because I'm going to report in like a month or so, you know, and I know that Stig is 80% of my revenue, I might want to consider the fact that Stig just said his sales are abysmal, because that is going to affect me a lot. And what you do is you get these customer supplier price reaction lags where, you know, you have information in the marketplace on another company that is economically linked to the company you're investigating, but you may get blindsided if you're just looking at the 10K in isolation, but not considering like the ecosystem. So that's another trick that a lot of like kind of varsity fundamental guys like to do. They kind of like to understand the ecosystem of what other guys are releasing.
Yeah, and just something to add to this, because Brian, I really think this is a great question, and you're starting with the 10Ks, because most investors, like even with years of experience, never go that far, so that's really good. One thing to say about this is that reading 10K is really an art. Like, you need to read quite a few really to get a grasp on this. I remember one of the first times I was reading this risk section, and I was like, I need to go through and read all the different types of risk, and it just seemed so generic. And guess what? Like, a lot of the risk that you do read about there is extremely generic. It's something like, oh, if we can't keep up with customer preferences, it's a problem for us. And I mean, try to see if you can find a business in the world that doesn't need to keep up with customer preferences. I mean, a lot of this is completely useless. And I think in general, you need to think about that whenever you're reading not only the risk section, but basically all the sections in the 10K. And the same goes for the management discussion. How sincere is it? Is it completely generic? Did they have someone from the PR department basically write that out? Or are they talking about mistakes they're actually making? Are we talking about the key drivers of the industry, where they are in the cycle? I mean, that's the things you should be looking for, because the requirements for 10K, in many ways, they're really strict because it's, all of this is regulated. But in a way, it's also very easy to get away with a lot of generic, useless talk. So if you can diagnose if it's sincere, in other better words, this is a trickle-down effect you see from the management and the rest of the organization. I know that this is really the art part that I'm talking about, because how do we determine that? But if you get the impression that they're trying to hide something from you, relating back to what Wes said before, they just suddenly got 15 new risk factors, then you probably should run away as fast as you can.
Well, I've got a question for Wes, because he was talking about this a little bit at the beginning of your response, Wes, about the operational income. So are you really big on really kind of going to the cash flow statement and looking at the operational income and then, you know, subtracting your CapEx to come up with your free cash flow? Is that what you're really seeing as the real earnings here?
Well, yeah, free cash flow is a little bit difficult because CapEx is all over the place. What I was suggesting is just move up the income statement. So at the top, you got the revenue, and then, you know, after your COGS, you got like your gross profitability, rip off some SG&A, you know, you're starting to get to like your EBITDA kind of, and then pull off some depreciation amortization, get the EBIT. Just all those are good. I mean, honestly, if I was just starting off value investing, whether I was a professional or not, I mean, because it's what we do, we focus on operating income, which is essentially, you know, EBIT. And then we look at total enterprise value, which is essentially like a price. And we just buy the cheapest ones.
Preston, I recently did an interview with Bill Miller. He's basically saying the same thing. He said that EBIT divided by enterprise value, that's really the indicator that you would go for. But Wes, I'm just going to throw it over back to you because I see you have another point here.
What does Warren Buffett do? I think he reads market psychology. And whenever he sees a firm, well, we already know what he does. Like Fresenius and those guys wrote a whole paper about it. It's called Buffett's Alpha. we know quantitatively what he does. He buys cheap, he buys quality, and he buys what they call low beta. Let's just punt that. They like systematically, effectively what Buffett does in his computer brain that none of us actually have, but he does. He's just buying cheap stocks that are high quality. Key is cheap and the key is quality. And all I think he does, he sits back and waits. Oh, IBM. Yeah, they're getting their butt kicked by Google. And yeah, they're not going to become like Google, but we don't need to become Google. They're a great firm and we just need them to do better than expected at the current price. And so all the positions he starts taking on, I think he just sits back and waits for the psychology to turn. He's earning his chops by focusing on market psychology, buying when everyone else thinks it's a stupid idea, and then just holding no matter what, even though he may look like an idiot in the short run.
All right. So, Brian, thank you so much for submitting your question. We really had fun answering that. For anybody that gets your question played on the show, we're going to give you a free subscription to our Intelligent Investor video course, where Stig goes chapter by chapter, step by step, teaching all the important lessons inside of the Intelligent Investor. So, Brian, you get a free subscription to our video course. So thank you so much for submitting that.
And Brian, you're also going to get the TIP Academy course, How to Invest in ETF, which is a process step by step that we outlined for you.
So if you guys are enjoying our conversation with Wes, make sure you guys tune in next week, because we have the second part of our interview where we continue this dialogue with Dr. Wesley Gray. And I'm telling you, you're definitely going to want to tune into that, because we really get into some interesting conversations into the second part. So Wes, I want to give you a quick opportunity. If people want to learn more about you or see some of your content, give them a handoff to where they can learn more about you.
Sure. The easiest place to do it is just go to alphaarchitect.com. And I'm sure you guys will link to it in the show notes. That's where we live on the internet.
And I also want to highlight your new book, Quantitative Momentum. If you're enjoying this conversation, I know for me, this is challenging a lot of my preconceived notions of investing, because I'm a hardcore value guy. But if you want to learn more about this, you've got to check out his book. I guarantee it's going to be one of the best books you read on momentum, because it's based on data. It's based on back testing that Wes has done. And that's something that I don't necessarily think you're going to find in a lot of books that are written about growth, which this isn't growth. And I think we've kind of dispelled some of that, but more on the momentum side, he backs it up with data and hard facts. So I can't help promote Wes's work highly enough, because it's something that will really help people challenge their way of thinking, especially if you come from a value investing background.
That was all that we had for this week's episode of the Investors Podcast. We will see each other again next week.
Thanks for listening to the Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to the Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application.